content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 27th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Netanyahu swings right to victory. What happened? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came from behind in the polls to win a clear and decisive victory in parliamentary elections this week, after retracting his support for a Palestinian state in a last-gasp appeal to conservative voters. Netanyahu's center-right Likud party won 30 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, easily outstripping the 24 secured by his main rival, the center-left Zionist Union Alliance. Netanyahu immediately opened negotiations with right-wing Orthodox and centrist parties, whose support he will need to form a coalition government. That alliance will likely be finalized in the next month. "Against all odds, we achieved a great victory," Netanyahu told supporters. "Now we have to form a strong and stable government." On Election Day, Netanyahu was accused of using anti-democratic scare tactics after he published a Facebook appeal to right-wing voters, warning that left-wing groups were busing droves of Arab-Israeli voters to the polls. The Joint Arab List, a newly formed alliance of four Arab parties, finished third with 14 seats and will probably play a key role in the opposition. President Obama, whose goal of securing a deal to limit Iran's nuclear program is fiercely opposed by Netanyahu, declined to congratulate the Israeli leader before he had formed a government. Instead, the White House praised Israel's democratic process. What the editorial said: "Looks like the celebratory champagne in the White House is going to stay corked," said the New York Post. Obama was clearly hoping for a regime change in Jerusalem and for a new prime minister, more amenable to making concessions to the Palestinians and far less likely to raise an angry voice on Iran. But that was wishful thinking. While Israelis might be weary of Netanyahu, who called the election 2 years early because of unrest in his ruling coalition, they realized that Bibi would protect their interests better than Zionist Union leader Isaac Herzog, an untested political neophyte. Netanyahu forfeited any claim to represent all Israelis with his outright rejection of a Palestinian state and racist rant against Arab-Israeli voters, said the New York Times. His demagogy throughout the campaign was breathtaking, from his pledge to build yet more legally questionable settlements in the West Bank to his subversive speech on Iran before the U.S. Congress. Having manifestly failed to address the issues Israelis really care about, the country's growing income disparity and soaring cost of living, a desperate Netanyahu could only resort to fear-mongering and anti-Arab attacks. What the columnist said: by casting off his insincere commitment to a two-state solution, Netanyahu may have initiated a significant change in American-Israeli relations, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. It's one thing to argue Palestinians must change their ways before they deserve statehood. It's quite another to say they should never have it. Now, Israel's many supporters in the U.S. must acknowledge their support, and they support an administration that wishes to deny Palestinians fundamental political, economic, and human rights, not just for the moment, but permanently. Unlike most Americans, Israel's voters have been paying attention to the history of the conflict, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. They've seen how the Palestinian leadership has refused peace offer after peace offer, and understand that a withdrawal from the West Bank now would duplicate the disastrous retreat from Gaza in 2005. Besides, both Likud and the Zionist Union are essentially in agreement on foreign policy. Neither can offer the Hamas terrorists who run Gaza anything that will tempt them to recognize the legitimacy of a Jewish state. And both remain adamantly opposed to appeasement of Iran. Bibi's desperation to win may have saved his political skin, said Jonathan Alter in the DailyBeast.com. But at what cost? Now that the Palestinians are the only party ostensibly interested in peace, their push for statehood will look increasingly legitimate. Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat who often reflects the view of the White House, has even hinted that the U.S. might start selectively lifting the American veto on pro-Palestinian resolutions at the United Nations Security Council. Netanyahu's victory will leave Israel beset by European boycotts, rebuked by international tribunals, and estranged from the U.S. president. As a second main story this week, Iranian-backed troops lead fight in Tikrit. What happened? The Iraqi operation to retake Tikrit from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria stalled this week with surrounded militants fighting fiercely to hold on to the city's center as questions grew over Iran's rising influence in the military offensive. An estimated 30,000 Iraqi troops are taking part in the operation, the largest one undertaken yet against the jihadist group in Iraq, and were reported to be waiting for reinforcements before making a final push into the city center, which ISIS has filled with booby traps and improvised explosive devices. At least two-thirds of the Iraqi forces are Shiite militias that have been trained and equipped by Iran, raising fears that Tehran was exploiting the ISIS crisis to forge stronger bonds with Iraq's Shiite-led government. Major General Qassem Soleimani, the controversial head of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, was photographed directing the offensive on Tikrit's front lines, and Iranian Safir 74 tanks were seen moving against ISIS positions. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey called Iran's involvement a positive thing for now, but said the U.S. was watching to see if Shiite militias conduct reprisals against the mostly Sunni population of ISIS-occupied central Iraq. "We are all very concerned about what happens after the drums stop beating and ISIS is defeated," Dempsey said. What the editorial said: slowly but surely, Iran is making Iraq a de facto Shiite satellite of Tehran, said the Wall Street Journal. The Islamic Republic has sent its Shiite militia proxies into Saddam Hussein's hometown as part of a strategic campaign to build an arc of Iranian dominance from Baghdad to Damascus to Beirut. This advance is all the more startling because it is occurring with tacit U.S. encouragement. By attacking ISIS from the air, President Obama is enabling militias directed by Soleimani to take control of the Sunni's Anbar province. "The U.S. and Iran might make strange bedfellows," said the Chicago Tribune. "But while the U.S. rebuilds and trains the Iraqi army over the next few months to take on ISIS, it needs Shiite militias in Iran to carry the fight against the jihadists. This arrangement, however, must be temporary. Once ISIS is evicted from Iraq, Obama must remind Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi that a military victory will be short-lived if Sunnis, Kurds, and Shiites in Iraq can't find a way to share power. If Abadi obeys Iran's mullahs, who seek a friendly Shiite-led client state, he will risk yet another Sunni jihadist uprising in the future." what the columnist said. The good news, ISIS is not some indomitable foe, said Gary Schmidt in the weeklystandard.com. As terrifying as the group's rise has been, the jihadists have been largely beaten into Crete by a gaggle of Shiite militiamen, regular Iraqi troops, and a few Sunni tribesmen. That's what makes Obama's reluctance to put boots on the ground so frustrating. With just one division of 10,000 to 30,000 troops, the U.S. could have routed ISIS by now and protected Iraqis from Iran's grasping tentacles. Instead, Obama has allowed Soleimani, Iran's so-called dark knight, to step out of the shadows and shepherd the fight, said Eric Oritz in NBCNews.com. A hugely powerful figure in Iran, Soleimani has been designated a known supporter of terrorism by Washington, D.C., and his Quds force helped supply the most powerful army-piercing IEDs used against U.S. troops in Iraq. Our new ally is drenched in American blood. Despite that ugly history, Obama now hopes to forge a less hostile relationship with Iran's leaders, said Jackson Deal in the Washington Post. If the Iranians agree to limit their nuclear program, he believes, the rogue nation might be coaxed into slowly rejoining the community of nations and playing a more responsible, stabilizing role in the shattered, terrorist-infested Middle East, including Iraq and Syria. Given how much Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei hates the U.S., said David Rothkopf of foreignpolicy.com, that's a very ambitious goal. Obama's Middle East strategy now depends heavily on the goodwill of not just Iran, but in particular of Khamenei. The U.S. better have a plan B. The controversy of the week. 2016. Why the GOP might turn to Rubio. Republicans may have a lot of impressive presidential candidates, said Mona Sharin in NationalReview.com, but only one of them is likely to win the general election. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is that candidate. Jeb Bush is hamstrung by Bush fatigue and the perception he's an establishment elitist. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has shown a troubling lack of foreign policy knowledge, and his fumbling of gotcha questions by reporters suggests he's not ready to solo with the big orchestra. Rubio, on the other hand, has proven over 4 years on the national stage to be the GOP's most inspirational speaker, and at 43, the telegenic senator would match up favorably with the 67-year-old Hillary Clinton. As a Cuban-American from humble beginnings, he would give the GOP some badly needed traction with working-class and Hispanic voters. Rubio is that rare candidate with ties to the GOP establishment and the conservative base, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. Rubio, more than anybody else, is the guy Republicans should want to earn the nomination. Rubio's new tax plan should disqualify him from the presidency, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The tax proposal he co-authored with Senator Mike Lee would cut taxes by $4 trillion over a decade, compared with $1.5 trillion for the Bush tax cuts. The plan's modest middle-class tax breaks are dwarfed by its mammoth giveaways to the super-rich, including the simple abolition of all and any taxes on capital gains, dividends, and estates. The plan would both gut the safety net and balloon the deficit, said Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. But Rubio doesn't care. He signed on to the disproven conservative theory that cutting taxes actually raises revenue by stimulating the economy. Bush thought so, too, and turned a surplus into a $1.3 trillion annual deficit as the economy crashed into a deep recession. Why would Rubio repeat such a catastrophic mistake? For conservatives, cutting upper income taxes isn't a practical imperative, it's a moral imperative. Rubio's foreign policy ideas are just as bad, said Daniel Larrison in theamericanconservative.com. In a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing last week, Rubio embarrassed himself by suggesting to Secretary of State John Kerry that the White House's efforts to combat the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria are too weak because of a desire not to upset Iran. Huh? Rubio seemed to be suggesting Iran doesn't want the Obama administration to fight ISIS, but Iran's Shiite leaders hate ISIS. The terrorist group's Sunni warriors threaten both Iraq's Shiite-led government and Iran's desire for regional dominance. Rubio may have a lot to say on foreign policy matters, but what he says is often wrong. Most Republicans would disagree, said Eliana Johnson in NationalReview.com. Inside the highest levels of the GOP, everybody's talking about Rubio. Big donors have soured on Bush and worry about Walker's readiness. All that stands between Rubio and true frontrunner status is his support for last year's Senate immigration bill, which would have granted legal status to many illegal immigrants. Whether that hurts him in the primaries remains to be seen. But according to the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, more Republicans say they could see themselves supporting Rubio, a full 56%, than anybody else. Clearly, Rubio is the potential nominee who makes the most sense on paper, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. He is ramping up his campaign slowly. But if Rubio keeps winning over influential conservatives, he could well be the one they are waiting for. Well, it was a good week for self-preservation after San Francisco 49ers linebacker Chris Borland, 24, retired after just 1 year in the NFL to spare himself from the brain damage that comes from frequent hard hits and concussions. From what I've researched and what I've experienced, Borland said, I don't think it's worth the risk. It was a good week for replacement units after doctors in South Africa reported the first successful penis transplant in medical history. It was a good week for humbling the exalted after Creflo Dollar, a televangelist at the World Changers Church, was forced by widespread ridicule to drop a fundraising drive to enable him to buy a $65 million Gulfstream jet. A spokesman said the Reverend Dollar might still seek to buy a plane if one comes along that is properly priced. It was a bad week for hanging out at home after police in Charlotte, North Carolina, declined repeated requests to arrest a local man who routinely stands naked at his front door. Unless he's outside of his home, said a department spokesman, he cannot be charged. And it was a bad week for British pride after researchers found that 4 out of 5 Britons do not steep their tea long enough for its proper flavor to emerge. The British think they know about tea, said a scientist, but most people have no idea what they are doing. And it was a bad week for missing deadline after a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor in Kentucky was arrested for having a library book that was 11 years past due. I'm not saying it's not serious, said Jonathan Masters, but I'm not a bad guy. And on the briefing page, the end of coal. To avoid catastrophic climate change, scientists say, we'll have to abandon the cheapest fossil fuel. What's wrong with coal? It's by far the dirtiest fuel source. Burning coal not only fills the air with soot and toxic heavy metals such as lead and mercury, but also produces roughly double the amount of carbon dioxide, a key greenhouse gas, that burning natural gas does. Coal consumption in the U.S. pumps about 1.575 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere annually, significantly more than the 1 billion tons generated by the country's entire fleet of gasoline-fueled cars. That's why climate scientists, environmentalists, and the Obama administration have targeted a massive reduction in coal use as a key tactic in the fight against global warming. If the world wants to avoid global temperatures rising more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the warming limit set by climate scientists for avoiding catastrophic damage, then 82% of the world's current coal reserves and 92% of the U.S.'s must be left in the ground, a recent Nature study concluded. There's enough carbon in the ground to really cook us, said former Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. What do we use coal for? Primarily to provide electricity. Coal-fired plants are the source of 38.7% of the electricity consumed in the U.S., and the average American uses 18 pounds of the fossilized plant matter a day to light his or her home and power the television, computer, smartphone, and other gadgets. Coal first became popular in the 18th century American home as a smokeless alternative to wood. As commercial mining grew in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and the Industrial Revolution reached America, its uses began to grow, first to power locomotives, and then to generate electricity for factories and homes. Today, the developing world is officially hooked on the cheap fuel, which is why there is no story of climate progress without a story for coal, says Julio Friedman, a coal specialist at the Department of Energy. That's what makes President Obama's vow to wean America off coal so challenging. What's Obama's strategy? Last June, the president unveiled his Clean Power Plan, overseen by the Environmental Protection Agency. His plan would cut the U.S. carbon footprint 30% from 2005 levels by 2030, mostly by reducing emissions from the country's 600 coal-fired plants. Each state has been assigned its own carbon footprint reduction, from 11% for North Dakota to 72% for Washington. States can try to reach those ambitious goals by switching to cleaner sources, including nuclear or natural gas-fired plants, and renewables like solar and wind power. If they want to keep their existing coal plants or build new ones, they'll have to install technology to scrub the emissions of most of the carbon. How have coal states responded? With anger. Red states with a big economic stake in coal production, such as Kentucky and Wyoming, have accused Obama of launching a war on coal. They argue the Clean Power Plan will destroy thousands of mining jobs and cause at least a 10% spike in utility bills. The president said he would bankrupt the coal industry, said Representative Mike Kelly, and he spent his presidency trying to do just that. Now these states are fighting back. Led by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the senator for coal-dependent Kentucky, 12 states have joined a lawsuit that accuses the EPA of federal overreach. But many energy experts argue that these states are in denial and that nothing can stop the decline of coal. Why is that? The economics of energy are changing. Even before Obama's clean energy push, the coal industry was hemorrhaging jobs. Coal mining employment in McConnell's Kentucky, for example, plummeted from 38,000 in 1983 to fewer than 17,000 in 2012. One factor in the decline is the shift from underground mines to open cast mining, a mostly automated technique that entails lopping off a mountaintop to create an open pit. But the biggest culprit for coal's decline is the fracking revolution, which has created a boom in natural gas, causing gas prices to plummet 74% in the last decade. Natural gas is now an affordable rival to coal in electrical generation, and it's much cleaner. In recent years, 150 coal-burning plants have shut down. So is coal dead? The future of energy production in the U.S. is shifting toward natural gas, with wind and solar playing smaller but growing roles. But coal remains very much alive in the developing world. India, where 340 million people have no access to electricity, has proposed building 455 coal-fired plants to meet this demand. In China, where coal provides a whopping 70% of the country's electricity, another 363 coal-fired plants were planned, though public concern over pollution may reduce that number. But it's highly unlikely that 82% of current global coal reserves will be left in the ground, says Earth's system scientist Stephen Davis. There is a global effort to reduce carbon dioxide, Davis said, but it is actually increasing at a shocking rate. Is clean coal possible? In theory, scientists and engineers have found a way to burn coal without fouling the atmosphere, but is it practical? Hopes for a cleaner coal rest on carbon capture and storage, an innovative technique being tested at a power plant in Kemper County, Mississippi. If it succeeds, the process could prevent about 65% of the carbon dioxide that's pumped out by the plant from reaching the atmosphere, making coal about as clean as natural gas. First, chemical processes are used to separate the carbon dioxide from coal's emissions. That carbon dioxide is then pumped off and buried underground. The technology works, but it is extremely expensive. The Kemper plant cost $5 billion and has yet to be proven commercially viable. But it might be the only way to clean up a fuel that still powers much of the world, said former Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. I don't see how we go forward without it, he says. Turn now to the columns. The first from the U.S., from Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times. Moynihan was right about poverty. 50 years ago this month, Democrats made a historic mistake, said Nicholas Kristof. They savagely attacked a report by federal official Daniel Patrick Moynihan that warned that the breakdown of the African-American family would make poverty more intractable. Moynihan wrote that from the wild Irish slums of the 19th century eastern seaboard to the riot-torn suburbs of Los Angeles, history had shown that communities in which the family breaks down end up in chaos, with fatherless young men caught up in lives of crime, substance abuse, and reckless sexual behavior. Liberals dismissed the future senator's report as racist and said Moynihan had no right to assume that middle-class American values are the correct values for everyone in America. But hard experience has proven Moynihan right. Today, 71% of African-American children are born to single mothers, as are 53% of Hispanic kids and 36% of white kids. Children with unmarried moms are five times more likely to live in poverty and 40% less likely to graduate from high school. So let's learn from 50 years of mistakes. It's not being a moral scold to acknowledge the role of families in fighting poverty. From Lithuania, Gintautas Mazikas at Delphi.it, how Russia whitewashes Soviet history. How would Jews feel if the museum at Auschwitz changed its focus to commemorate the noble work of the camp's Nazi guards, asked Gintautas Mazikis. This is how Lithuanians feel about the recent revamp of the only preserved camp in the Soviet Gulag system. Located in Russia's southern Urals, Perm 36 was the site of the torture of numerous political prisoners, many of them from the Lithuanian Soviet Socialist Republic. In 1992, after the USSR dissolved, the Russian Human Rights Group Memorial preserved Perm 36 so that later generations of Russians could understand the horrors of Stalinism. But now, after more than a decade under President Vladimir Putin, Russian authorities have declared Memorial's members to be foreign agents, and the Museum to Victims of Stalin's Repression is being dismantled. In its place will be a museum to the penal system, and some of the managers include the very prison guards who abused Lithuanians' dissidents. Soon the site will extol the heroic resistance of the Soviet people, with exhibits that demonstrate how well the Gulag prevented dissidents from committing new crimes against the state. It's all part of the passionate new Soviet revanchism that is sweeping Russia. History, beware. From Japan, an editorial at the Japan Times, when fire rained down from the sky. Americans learn about the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but do they know what else their military did here? Asked the Japan Times. 5 months before the Enola Gay made its fateful flight, the U.S. Air Force firebombed residential Tokyo, dropping 1,700 tons of incendiary bombs and killing some 100,000 civilians. The March winds whipped up fire tornadoes that burned thousands alive. Many others suffocated to death. Tokyo's rivers were clogged with corpses. The commander who ordered the raid, Curtis LeMay, justified the indiscriminate bombing by arguing that people in private homes were producing small parts for use in weapons, and therefore the entire city was a weapons factory. 70 years later, the victims of the great Tokyo air raid have never been compensated. In 2007, more than 100 survivors tried to sue the Japanese government, arguing that if Japan hadn't bombed Pearl Harbor, the air raid would not have happened. The Supreme Court rejected the suit, though, and the survivors got nothing. Now that Japan's government is trying to change the Constitution to allow our military to fight overseas, we should all remember that in war, civilians pay the highest price in suffering and death. Our in-depth article this week, The World's Most Powerful Woman. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is the key to containing Russia, says Michael Petru. What makes her tick? Erika Binn, a fast-talking 77-year-old woman who guided generations of East German students through the nuances of the Russian language, is reminiscing about one of her students, a girl so shy that in the black and white group photographs Ben pulls from a scrapbook, she is barely visible. Angela Kosner, as she was known then, was always an excellent student, said Ben, but she had a problem. Some of the events in the Russian language Olympics involved acting out situational conversations, such as meeting a friend on the street or discussing weekend plans. Expressive students were more likely to impress the judges, but Angela appeared before them, staring at her feet, hands hanging limply at her side. I was very angry at her because she was so good, but she wouldn't demonstrate codes of proper behavior, said Ben. Yet Angela did the considerable amount of work Ben assigned her without complaint, and she somehow forced herself to be exuberant during competitions, speaking loudly, looking others in the eye, and gesturing with her hands. None of it came naturally to Angela, said Ben. She did it because she concluded it was necessary, because she wanted to win. And she did. Today, Angela Kosner is Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany for nearly a decade, unofficial leader of Europe during a time of financial turmoil, and the West's most important asset as it confronts a resurgent and expansionist Russia. Merkel holds power lightly, says a senior official close to her, because she understands that the rest of Europe will accept her command only if she involves her partners. German history casts a long shadow and prevents a chancellor, even today, from appearing the least bit authoritarian. It is Merkel, too, who oversees efforts to negotiate an end to the devastating war between Ukrainian government forces and Russian-backed rebels. She's the only person Vladimir Putin takes really seriously. It's not Obama. It's no one else from the European Union. It's Merkel who really matters to him as a powerful person in this conflict, says Stefan Meister, an Eastern Europe expert at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Domestically, Merkel is unassailable. Polls put her approval rating around 70%. She leads a grand coalition that holds more than 500 out of 631 seats in the German parliament, or Bundestag. There are no obvious challengers to Merkel within her party, the Christian Democratic Union, and no term limits for German chancellors. Powerful figures, including Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen, who was often discussed as a potential successor, are said to be loyal. Merkel will step down when she feels like it, not when she's forced. In the meantime, Merkel has governed Germany and increasingly Europe with the same pragmatic approach that won her victory in those Russian language competitions. She recognizes what must be done and does it, whether it comes naturally to her or not. It's absolutely not her style to lead, says Martin Lau, a political correspondent at the German weekly newspaper Die Zeit. She negotiates and calms other people's temper tantrums, but she doesn't like to lead, and she doesn't pontificate. She doesn't verbalize leadership. She doesn't like all these things, and still she has to do it. There's no one else. There simply isn't. Merkel was never hungry for the trappings of power, the wealth, the prestige, and the deference. She doesn't need adoration and lives modestly. And yet, and in part because of those qualities, she's emerged as the one figure uniquely suited to deal with two of the biggest crises facing the West today. She grew up among the mentally disabled. Shortly after she was born in 1954, Merkel's father, Horst Kosner, a Protestant pastor, moved his family from Hamburg in West Germany to the village of Kietzow in East Germany. 3 years later, they relocated to Templin, a town surrounded by forests and lakes and a Soviet military garrison. Here, Merkel spent most of her youth. Her family had a home at the Waldhof, a church-administered complex where disabled Germans lived and worked. Horst ran a pastoral college on the grounds. Merkel lived there with her parents, brother and sister. She once told the photographer Herlin Köbel, there is no shadow over her childhood. According to Ben, Merkel was withdrawn as a girl and a little bit isolated. She wasn't particularly popular, but nor was she bullied. Her peers, said Ben, respected her academic talents. Merkel joined the Free German Youth, the FDJ, a movement associated with the ruling Socialist Unity Party of Germany for those ages 14 to 25. Alan McDougall, a University of Guelph historian, says that for East Germans who wanted to go to university, membership in the FDJ was pretty much a prerequisite. There has still been the odd accusation that Merkel compromised herself by joining the group. This type of criticism has never found much traction among Germans, especially among those who grew up in East Germany, where tens of thousands of people either worked or were informers for the Stasi East Germany secret police. Merkel did neither of these things. Merkel studied physics at the University of Leipzig and earned a doctorate in 1978. She was living in East Berlin and working as a researcher the night the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. She did briefly cross to the West, but only after keeping her regular Thursday night sauna appointment. If this was an event she had long dreamed about, she doesn't seem to have been in much of a hurry to realize it. Exactly why Merkel chose to pursue politics is not clear, but her career took off once the wall fell. At 36, she contested the first post-reunification federal election in 1990 and entered the Bundestag as a CDU member. She was quickly appointed to Chancellor Helmut Kohl's cabinet and remained one of his protégés until his defeat in the 1998 federal election. She was elected CDU leader in 2000, paving the way for a failed run at the chancellorship in 2002, followed by a successful one in 2005. Around the same time as Kohl's long career as chancellor was coming to an end, Merkel married chemist and professor Joachim Sauer, whom she had met years before. An earlier marriage to Ulrich Merkel had ended when she was still in her 20s. But she kept his name. Today, Merkel and Sauer live in what, from the outside, looks like a plain Berlin apartment in a building next to the River Spree. Professor Dr. Sauer is the name on the buzzer. There's a cafe downstairs that sells basic lunch food and cakes. A police car is often parked about a block away, with an officer or two sometimes standing on the sidewalk. There are no gates or barriers. Foreigners don't know that Merkel lives here. Germans don't care. The personal lives of Merkel and Putin in many ways reflect the intertwined histories of their two countries. While Merkel studied German language and culture during the Cold War, Putin studied German. He was working for the KGB and was stationed in Dresden when the wall came down. The two can converse in both Russian and German and do so regularly. Last September, the Kremlin reported Putin had spoken with Merkel 35 times so far that year, more than three times the number of phone conversations he'd had with Obama. She has a deep understanding of the Russian mentality, the Russian language. I think she understands him, says Thomas Stritzel, a CDU Bundestag member. But the sheen of mutual respect and perhaps trust is all gone now because of Russian aggression in Ukraine and Putin's denials about it. She was very disappointed that he lied to her several times on some agreements on how Russia supports the separatists, said Stefan Liebig, a Bundestag member. A senior official described Merkel's relationship with Putin as one without illusions. Yet Merkel never scaled back her diplomatic efforts with Putin, even as she must have felt the personal insult of betrayal. Asked what motivates his boss, Peter Tauber, General Secretary of the CDU, says, "Peace." But Merkel is not a reflexive pacifist. She has kept German troops in Afghanistan as part of a NATO-led training and advisory mission. Germany's deployment was recently extended for another year. What's driving Merkel's diplomacy on Ukraine may not be so much a desire for peace as a fear of a larger and bloodier war on Europe's doorstep. There is a complex of old buildings in Merkel's hometown of Templin that used to be a boarding school. The buildings are now dilapidated. The yellow paint is chipped. The windows are boarded up. But the structures themselves, surrounded by forest, are stately and beautiful. Ulrich Schoenig, a former mayor of Tempen, is on a committee with Merkel's mother, Herlinde Kosner, that hopes to establish a new school here. Schoenig says he and Kosner were recently discussing help they might request from Germany's education minister. They planned to send a letter, but worried it would be lost or ignored among the voluminous correspondence the ministry surely receives. Angela is coming home for Christmas, Kosner said, according to Schoenig. Maybe I should ask her to deliver the letter. Kosner later told him Merkel had refused. He wasn't surprised. Few in Germany would be. There's never been a whiff of corruption or scandal surrounding Merkel. Even using her influence to ensure a letter from her mother reaches its intended destination is apparently something she won't contemplate. It's one of the reasons Germans trust her. In Merkel, Germans see traits they want to believe are their own. Thrift, modesty, rationality, a willingness to work hard. She represents all the things that we think are typically German, says journalist Ralph Bollmann. Germans like to imagine Merkel cooking potato soup, he says. And it's these perceived values that have helped Merkel convince Germans of austerity's necessity as a strategy for dealing with the euro crisis. That Merkel doesn't project a sense of grandeur makes Germans more comfortable with their chancellor playing a bigger role internationally. Outside the country, it may also take some of the sting out of Germany dominating Europe again. It's precisely because she doesn't want to lead that German leadership is conceivable, Lau of Die Zeit says. Those who know Merkel describe her as less guarded in private, a little more chatty and prone to make jokes, but not all that different from how she is in public. There's no sense of a cruel or pompous personality lurking behind the public persona. Some of Merkel's critics accuse her of lacking vision. Her chancellorship is so far without grand and singular achievements. But after three election victories and nearly a decade in office, Merkel's chancellorship has acquired its own weight and impact. She has governed longer than most of her peers in the world, with a notable exception in Putin. Merkel has kept Germany wealthy and stable as many of the countries around it struggle. Germany's strength has resulted in a steady increase in its standing and influence in the world. This, in turn, has forced upon Merkel the issues that will likely define her political career: the Eurozone crisis and the war in Ukraine. Both are confounding crises, and neither is close to being resolved. But the worse these problems get, the more the world looks to Germany's reluctant leader to solve them. Other world leaders are powerful. Merkel is close to indispensable. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Maclean's. Turn back to the health and science page now. When the red planet was partly blue. Astronomers have found the strongest evidence yet that ancient Mars had a massive ocean for millions of years, an indication that the red planet once had everything necessary to support life. Shortly after Mars formed 4.5 billion years ago, NASA scientists say, the planet was wet, with enough water to cover the entire planet to a depth of about 450 feet. Most of the water, however, was concentrated in an ocean covering Mars' northern hemisphere. That ocean, slightly larger than Earth's Atlantic Ocean, reached depths of about a mile. The astronomers arrived at this conclusion through an analysis of water molecules in Mars' current atmosphere. They measured two slightly different forms of water. typical H2O and HDO, a naturally occurring variation in which one hydrogen atom is replaced by a heavier version called deuterium. When Mars' atmosphere thinned and the surface water evaporated into space, deuterium concentrations increased over time. By analyzing how quickly this process occurred, scientists could infer that Mars lost about 87% of its water over 4.5 billion years. The existence of a northern ocean has been debated for decades, but this is the first time we have such a strong collection of data from around the globe. Michael Mumma, principal investigator at NASA's Goddard Center for Astrobiology, tells the New York Times, "Our results tell us there had to be a northern ocean." The health scare of the week. Depression raises heart risks. Stress and depression can take a combined toll on the heart, creating a psychosocial perfect storm that dramatically increases the risk of death from heart disease, new research has found. A study involving nearly 4,500 adults with coronary artery disease found that those who suffered from significant stress and depression were nearly 50% more likely to die or have a heart attack during a 6-year study, regardless of other risk factors. A separate study, meanwhile, found that having a strong sense of purpose in life actually lowers the risk of heart disease and stroke. Developing and refining your sense of purpose could protect your heart health and potentially save your life. Cardiologist Randy Cohen, the study's lead author, tells ScienceDaily.com. People with goals that are important to them, his analysis of 10 studies involving 130,000 people found, are 23% less likely to die over a given period than those without such goals. On the Talking Points page, racist chant, an exercise in free speech. When several University of Oklahoma frat boys were caught on video chanting a vile racist song last week, it triggered a tidal wave of outrage, said David French in NationalReview.com. Their fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, shut down the OU chapter while students and faculty marched in protest. But then OU President David Boren did something really boneheaded. He summarily expelled two students who led the chant. As head of a public university, Boren should have known that was a flagrant violation of their First Amendment rights. The Constitution protects all speech, no matter how hateful, and public universities, as representatives of the government, cannot punish people for expressing verboten ideas. Disgusting as the chant was, it didn't specifically threaten an individual, said Christian Fares in NewRepublic.com. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that such speech is protected by the Constitution. If the First Amendment cannot distinguish between racist filth and true academic debate, it is time to rethink what it means, said Kent Greenfield in TheAtlantic.com. Is the slippery slope so slick that we cannot fathom any restrictions on the worst speech? It's all very well to insist that the best antidote to hateful speech is counter speech, but that places the burden of responding on the targets of the hatred. Black people shouldn't have to explain why they shouldn't be lynched. Boren did the right thing by expelling the offenders, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Obviously, those pampered, privileged children aren't likely to physically attack black people. But the Greek system's old boy network would guide many of them into top executive positions, where they would have hiring and firing powers. What chance would an African-American job applicant have of getting fair consideration? Actually, those Neanderthals shouldn't have been expelled, said S.E. Cupp in the New York Daily News. Instead, they should be forced to face their peers every day, including the 1,500 black students who attend the university. A heaping dose of shame and ridicule would be good medicine. The frat boys should also be required to take black history and women's study courses in order to graduate. Teaching bigots tolerance is surely better than allowing them to crawl off campus into the cold comfort of anonymity. And a few notes as we wind down. After receiving 2.9 inches of snow on Sunday, Boston totaled a historic 108.6 inches for the season, topping the previous record of 107.6 inches set in 1995-96. Since the start of the Syrian Civil War 4 years ago, the average life expectancy in the country has dropped from 79.5 years to 55.7 years, about the same as South Sudan and Malawi, according to the new UN report. On the poll watch, 60% of Republicans think that Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email address while she was Secretary of State is a very serious problem, up from 44% last week. Only 8% of Democrats agree, down from 17% last week. 68% of Americans support negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program, including 65% of Republicans. 49% of Americans think that Republican senators' letter to Iranian leadership went too far. And here's a quote that I can relate to finish things off, from George Orwell. He says, "On the whole, human beings want to be good, but not too good, and not quite all the time." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.